You're listening to Doing It Right with me, Pandora Sykes, a podcast where I talk to experts about the myths, anxieties, and trends of modern life. In this series, Series 4, I'll be exploring topics including postpartum psychosis, sociopathy, and how technology has flattened personal taste. This is a podcast that asks, what can we do to understand life better? Not just for ourselves, but for everyone. For the first time ever, I'm dropping the whole series in one as a capsule box set. So tuck in and don't forget to let me know your thoughts at doingitrightpod@gmail.com. Kyle Chaker is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he writes about tech and social media culture. He's also the author of a book, Filter World: How Algorithms Flattened Culture, about how technology has come to shape and oversee what we think of as personal taste. What we watch, what we listen to, how we shop, even how we travel. The homogenization or memification of taste is something I've been thinking about for a long time. In my 2020 essay collection, How Do We Know We're Doing It Right, which spawned this very podcast, I wrote an essay called Get the Look, about how internet culture encouraged young women to dress as facsimiles of each other. It was inspired by that Zara polka dot dress. If you don't know which dress I mean, Google it. Kyle has zoomed out to look at how the algo has flattened all aspects of popular culture. Music, TV, movies, coffee shops. We discuss the homogenization of taste, the paradox of choice, decision fatigue, surveillance capitalism, and whether or not an algorithm could, in fact, make a fairer recommendation than a human tastemaker, all of whom come with their own biases. I had such fun talking to Kyle, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Let's start with the basics for any Luddites listening. What is an algorithm, and how did it come to shape our tastes?
An algorithm essentially is just an equation. So the word itself just refers to any kind of equation that you use to do anything. But I think in the contemporary context, in the kind of 2010s internet, an algorithm refers to the recommendation systems that drive so many of the feeds that we experience. So that's like your Facebook feed, your Netflix homepage, your Spotify playlists, your TikTok For You videos, kind of everything we consume on the internet now is driven by these recommendations.
And Filter World is your exploration of how that has come to flatten and homogenize our tastes, or as one of your interviewees more generously calls it, the harmonization of taste. And one of your key early examples is the generic coffee shop, capital G, capital C, capital S, which also reminded me of a piece I think Emily Sundberg wrote in The Cut about the shoppy shop, which is the upmarket deli. And I've got one at the end of my road, the upmarket deli, which markets itself as kind of one-off and cute, but sells, as they all do, those sardines in a can, the fizzy Spanish water, etc. But with the generic coffee shop in particular, you say this transcended the usual indicators of globalization. How so?
Right. I mean, when we usually think of globalization, it might be something like a McDonald's chain or like Starbucks showing up in Beijing. It's like a corporation that chooses to expand to other countries and creates this kind of generic experience. But in this case, it was cafe owners who are all very independent, who are all very local, consciously choosing to design their cafes in the same way, with these same like tropes that I think everyone recognizes, with generic subway tile on the wall and reclaimed wood furniture and succulents in ceramic pots and cappuccinos with latte art. So I think that's become this like recognizable, granular, globalized experience that wasn't dictated from the top down, but instead came from the bottom up, which I think is driven by platforms like Instagram.
I wondered if Soho House had any bearing on it as well. I don't know if that's more of like a European name check, but I can remember when Soho House started and it was very exciting and quite unique for its decor. And now obviously it's it's become a huge members club. I think there's 250,000 members worldwide, maybe. But what I've been really interested in is seeing how other hotels, whether they're hotel chains or independent boutiques, have mimicked the Soho House, which, to be fair, is an extremely comfortable, smart interior decor. Like, they really nailed the combination.
For sure.
But it really is now, it's so widely memed in terms of decor. Do you think the same thing kind of happened with the coffee shop, that one independent cafe owner saw it worked and another did it? Or do you think it's like a really subconscious thing that we just don't know how to design now without looking at what someone else has done via the internet?
I mean, I do think we don't know how to design without looking at the internet, because that's just where everything is nowadays. Like, Instagram is this collective mood board that we're all working from. But I also think it is like someone figured out a solution. I think the template was kind of established in Australian cafes with the, you know, avocado toast and flat whites that you now see everywhere. But like Soho House, it's a kind of template that works wherever you go. Like, Soho House is a kind of aesthetic and a set of symbols and like ideas and atmospheres that you can repeat anywhere. I mean, I remember going to the Istanbul Soho House, which is in this huge diplomatic building, I think, maybe a former embassy. And it's just so wild to see the collision of this very specific international space combined with the generic Soho House interior. And yet it's still very cool and nice.
I wrote an essay a few years ago. Kyle, thank you so much. This yearning for sameness played out in fast fashion, or faster than fast fashion, that sort of new Shein tier. And notably, there was a dress several years ago from Zara, which was a midi-length polka dot dress, which was so prevalent across the UK. It had its own... Was it a thing in the States as well?
I think it was more over the internet. Like, if you were paying attention to these things, it became the dress. And we had our own version with, like, the Amazon parka.
Oh, really?
That also was incredibly popular 1 year. But yeah, I totally know the dress.
It had its own Instagram account. At one point, there was like a convention. I remember walking down the street and seeing three women having a drink together wearing this dress. And I felt like I was in The Handmaid's Tale. And it was funny, but it was also wildly depressing, because the more people wore it, the more people wanted it. And the reason so many people wanted this dress is not because it was excellent. It's because it was inoffensive. How have you seen this desire for the mediocre parlayed across culture more generally?
It's kind of the lowest common denominator. like that dress, the polka dot dress, is like a meme that spreads in real life, just like a meme would spread over the internet. Like, it replicates itself. The more popular it is, the more popular it then becomes. Like, people want to copy it and replicate it. So I feel like you can track that lowest common denominator in different fields of culture, whether it's like the fast fashion or the generic cafe design or the kind of Spotify core music that some people have identified that just sounds the same, like drum loops and synth washes and breathy female vocals, or TikTok voice, like the kind of vocal patter that a lot of influencers use on TikTok, or Instagram face, which was Gia Tolentino's term for the kind of like influencer plastic surgery that transcended geographic boundaries.
That's sort of ethnically ambiguous, but also at the same time, yes, like quite racially problematic. I'm trying to think how it parlays in fiction and film. I'm guessing in film it would be all of these like Netflix original and Amazon original films, which, you know, Lindsay Lohan seems to be in 90% of them now. And she's having like a great time. I actually think it's really her era. But, you know, I keep watching them and thinking, that is so terrible. How has that been made? But it is comforting. I put them on when I am looking for comfort, which is the problem in itself, I think, isn't it? That's what we see as nourishing when it's actually the opposite.
You just want to not be provoked. You don't want to think about anything. You don't want to feel anything in a way. And so it's this pleasant neutrality that I think goes through a lot of culture right now.
And it makes sense, right? Because we're so overly stimulated by the modern world. But I guess I never realized that I knew that it was a time suck, but I never realized that it could actually be dangerous until I was interviewing a couple of weeks ago for this series a sociologist who talked about his theory of languishing, which is when you are apathetic and you can't find meaning in life. And he was talking about how passive entertainment is really bad for you, and active entertainment is what gives you meaning. And I was wondering how much of that mediocre passive, how much we're doing damage to ourselves essentially with that lowest common denominator.
I mean, I think the way that we consume that lowest common denominator stuff or the passive entertainment is through all of these feeds. Like, we've come to rely on all of the feeds to deliver us that stuff that's not going to provoke us, it's not going to make us think about anything. I think Spotify has this separation between lean in and lean back listening. And lean back is when you're just like letting yourself go on the algorithmic tide and consuming whatever is delivered to you and like not really thinking about it too much. Whereas lean in is when you're actually paying attention to what you're listening to, choosing what songs or albums you're playing and thinking about it. So I think a lot of this is lean back entertainment. And I think, I mean, it's, you know, mental health wise, perhaps it's not the best, but I think it's really bad for like culture as a whole that most of what succeeds now is this lean back experience that's like almost intentionally meaningless. And that's like, we don't want everything to be so meaningless. Like, we would like to find meaning.
You point out that we are, or at least we feel like we are, culturally exhausted, emotionally exhausted. And of course, the upshot of the algorithm is that it takes away something many of us find exhausting, which is decision making. Do you think we are peak decision fatigue, or do you think it's going to get worse?
Oh, man. I mean, we are definitely exhausted from making decisions. I think part of the problem is just the nature of the internet as it emerged in the past like 15 years. Like, there is too much stuff on the internet.
More. Yeah. It's extraordinary.
No human being can confront that volume of stuff. And so we need filters, we need curation, we need things to sort it out for us, because we can't make all those decisions. So we are like overwhelmed by decisions and thus give up our agency in a lot of ways. But I think now it's like, hopefully we're realizing it's too much giving up on decision making, and we're ready to make a few more decisions for ourselves and be more intentional about our consumption habits.
The problem with the liked this, try this thing is that it keeps you in the same cultural wheelhouse, so to speak. It turns you inward and it keeps you insular. And more often than not, as you've said, it recommends the lowest common denominator of content. What do you see as the dangers of seeking sameness?
I think it has a way of just reaffirming your own preconceptions and your own sense of what you like and kind of who you are as well. So I think algorithmic feeds often work like funnels. Like, they collect a bunch of people and attention and then funnel it toward one kind of category. So it sorts you into a type of person or a type of interest, and then just feeds you that over and over and over again. And so that has a way of not surprising you, of not challenging you, of not bringing you new ideas or new things that you may have not encountered before. And I think that's, I mean, one of the worst qualities of that is it's very boring. It's like, one of the problems with that is it becomes very boring and you hit a dead end of taste and culture. And at a certain point, you're just not interested in that anymore. Like, we need a way out of that cul-de-sac.
And of course, that has dangerous political ramifications as well. I mean, humans are instinctively tribal, and we have learned, or most of us have learned, to fight against that or to educate ourselves beyond that. But then when you have an entire kind of cultural blanket encouraging you to stay in your very specific set of knowledge and experience and enjoyment and everything like that, I think that might be part of why we are so incredibly polarized at the moment.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think in cultural terms, this funnel is really big. Like, it funnels us all toward the same kind of taste or the same aesthetics. But then in politics or more identity stuff, the funnels are very separate. Like, in American political terms, like, you are either a Republican or a Democrat. Like, you're either a conservative or a liberal. You cannot merge those two groups. They're like fundamentally opposed to each other at this point. And yet you're sorted into one of them or the other. There's kind of one way to belong in one group and one way to belong in the other. And I think part of that is this like sorting mechanism and the opposition that that comes with. Like, you are opposed to people who are not in your category.
Do you not think that's kind of happened a little bit with culture as well? I've always been fascinated by how much people will say, oh, I wouldn't read that. I only read literary fiction, or I wouldn't watch that. I don't watch. And I've always rubbed up against that. And I've always very deliberately tried to kind of sample from the entire platter because I'm just curious like that. But I'm constantly surprised by how many people feel like their tastes are very specific and they have to remain specific in order to say something about them.
Yeah, like you are encouraged to identify with a very small set of consumption habits. Like Netflix will tell you that you are like a romantic comedy person and just deliver your romantic comedies over and over to the point that you might just be like, oh, well, the only thing I watch is romantic comedies. Like, it tells the algorithmic feed or recommendations tell you who you think you are in a way, and then you don't have the curiosity or the energy or the impetus to go outside of that and try something different.
You spoke a little earlier about the paradox of choice and how too much choice can render us powerless, or at least unable to make a decision. And I was really fascinated by your take that when we have lots of choice, not only do we struggle to make a decision, but whatever decision we do make can feel meaningless. I could be listening to anything, you write, so why should this one thing feel important to me? Is that something — I've never looked at it like that, and I found that really interesting — is that something you feel when you watch something or listen to something?
For sure. I mean, it's a personal reflection, at least. Like, when you do have access to everything on Spotify, how do you impart meaning to the one album that you are choosing to listen to? I think you need to consciously build a relationship with the culture you're consuming more intentionally, like not just letting your consumption habits be pushed around by recommendations or by the platform dynamics, but instead really be aware of what and why you're what you're consuming and why you're choosing it. Just because otherwise, if you are not making the choice is going to be made for you very passively.
Totally. You also write that the central dilemma of filter world is whether or not technology can make a fairer recommendation than a human. So once upon a time, what films were streamed on TV, what stories were published in a paper, what songs were played on the radio, they were controlled by humans who, you write, are mercurial and riddled with their own blind spots. But the algorithmic feed is conforming to the tenet of a tech company even more powerful and blinkered than an editor. Could you talk to me a little more about that dilemma and where you think where's the golden spot? That's not a phrase, but hopefully you know what I mean.
Right. I mean, I think dilemma is the right word. Like, we've gone through these different eras of cultural distribution, let's say. Like, in decades past, we did have these human tastemakers and decision makers who did choose what goes in the theater, what goes on TV, what goes in the newspaper. Now the sorting mechanism is not a person in a room making a choice, but this equation that gauges how much attention something is getting, how many clicks it's getting, and then promotes it more automatically. So I think there are good and bad sides to both of those. Like, human gatekeepers can be really bad. Like, there are racial biases, there are identity biases, there are just taste biases that get projected to a whole culture at large. But I do think a human tastemaker like that has the ability to bring in something new to the conversation, to point at something that might not be popular and kind of put it into the zeitgeist, to put it in front of people. Whereas the algorithmic feed cannot do that. It doesn't make that creative leap. It can only make that decision of what gets attention already gets more attention in the future.
Tell me about your experiment when you dressed only according to Amazon's Echo fashion consultant or something.
It was this product that existed in, I think, the late 2010s that was quickly discontinued for reasons that may become obvious. But it was a little camera that stood up on your shelf and you could take outfit selfies with it. And it promised to judge your style and judge your fashion sense. And so I used it.
So it's basically like Instagram.
Yes, I mean, yeah, not an automated version of Instagram or people commenting at you, except, you know, telling you you're wrong in this case. So it would grade my outfits. And it had some weird decisions that it made for me, like I should pop my collar on my shirts, which I did not agree with.
You got a really preppy Echo Dot.
It certainly seemed like that. It also wouldn't explain why it found one thing more fashionable than another. And style and fashion is so personal and context specific. I just don't think that's something that can be automated away by an equation.
What did it tell you to wear anything really funky, or was it the opposite? Did it tell you to put together really, really dull outfits, thus conforming to the sameness?
Yes. Yeah. So just like, honestly, I think the outfit it liked the most might have been like monochrome gray. So it was like literally the least interesting. But I hope that people don't overly rely on these things to just like automate away all of their cultural taste that like is supposed to make us who we are.
I read a really interesting take on this recently in Anne Cadet's newsletter. Anyway, she was a columnist at an American publication, and now she's got a Substack newsletter, and she only wears black. She has like 30 items of clothing. And she was writing about how it wasn't passive and it wasn't like a depressing, mediocre choice. It was actually a really exciting, liberating choice for her. And she wrote about all the ways in which it had enriched her life. And it was such a lovely take, because I never would have looked at it in that way.
Yeah. Making that decision for yourself is really empowering. I think like whatever decision you make,
just have to make it for yourself.
yeah, exactly. It's not, you're not wearing black because, oh, you moved to New York and that's what you feel like people do. It's a creative choice that you're making, that you are expressing yourself through and identifying with. It's not like the Amazon machine telling you, oh, you should only wear black.
True. And she was also saying that she loves when people dress in kind of technicolor glory. She enjoys saying that on the street just for herself. She loves the uniform, why people wear. Right. I always find that really interesting. I used to work in fashion, and loads of the best designers would have a really boring uniform because all of their creativity went into their clothes. They didn't want to think about what they had to wear, like Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with this like algorithmic culture is that there is no one answer for everyone.
Yeah.
There isn't like a net mediocrely good, okay solution. There's no like one answer to how we're fashionable.
I don't think there's any such thing as good taste or bad taste.
There's only trying to have taste, or I guess avoiding it. Like,
I think there's just like majority taste or minority taste. And sometimes the taste might be very minority, which is when it is called bad taste. I was reading a terrifying article this week by a journalist called Matilda Davies, who realized that because she had said yes to some cookies from Meta, however long ago she joined Facebook, that the company had been logging information on her an average of 33 times a day for the last decade, what Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism. And I think we think, well, certainly, you're a technology reporter, so you won't have thought this, but I had thought naively that when we say yes to something like tracking on Facebook, we are saying yes to them logging our activity on that particular site, right, or app only. But actually, they're logging every single decision everywhere we make on our tech through these cookies. Should we all be being more careful to opt out, clearing out our cookies?
I think so. I think it has been nice to see with the GDPR rules in the European Union and the UK, I think, that you're given the option to opt out even. Because before, we were not given the option to stop that tracking. But like advertising online, targeted advertising, I don't know anyone who likes it. I don't know anyone who is like, I'm so glad that this microwave from Amazon is following me around the internet. So I hope in the future we can find some like different way of getting around this.
Can you clear this up for me once and for all? Does your telephone listen to you and then suggest,
oh, man,
like the trainers you've been talking about?
Look, I have read many articles and I fully believe like that reporting says that it doesn't listen to you, but experience tells me that something bizarre is happening. Like, I had a cold a few months ago and I was talking with my wife about like cough syrup or something. And then I suddenly get ads for NyQuil on my Instagram. Like, I didn't Google anything. I didn't like give any digital hint that I was feeling sick. And all of a sudden it's advertising in front of me. So we're in the uncanny valley and something incredibly bizarre is happening.
The argument against that, right, is because you've been talking about it, you're subconsciously aware of it. My husband and I were talking about some trainers and we were talking about how you pronounce the brand name. We certainly weren't Googling it. We weren't thinking of buying any. And then we went onto a website, or I went onto a website, and there was a banner ad for them. And I was trying to work out if it had been listening to me, something had been listening to me, or if I just then noticed them because I had been recently talking about them.
Yeah, it could be like confirmation bias. But that's what was so weird about the cough syrup, is that like there's no other reason. I don't normally get advertised cold medicine in my Instagram feed.
Maybe there was a cold epidemic that week and NyQuil thought, right, let's put some paid advertising on Instagram.
It could totally be. But I mean, the fact that we're so alienated by this, the fact that it feels bad when these things happen, I think speaks to our ennui or dissatisfaction with just this whole digital environment anyway.
I was also really interested in your exploration of how the algorithm can warp language. For example, it will hide posts that contain certain words. So we've seen the emergence of what Taylor Lorenz called algo speak, SA for sexual assault, unalive for kill. I did not understand that one till recently. The spicy eggplant for the vibrator, and more recently people have been putting a 3 in Palestine, for example. On the flip side, you noticed, and this made me laugh, you discovered that if you wrote a fake marriage announcement on your Instagram posts, which would be about a piece of your writing, they'd get shown to more of your audience. How much is the algorithm putting blinkers on us, sort of sanitizing the world into this very heteronormative weddings and babies and never showing you anything about sexual violence? How much is it putting blinkers on us against our will and sometimes even against our knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's often against our knowledge. Like, we are not made aware of how these systems work. They're not transparent. And often the moderation rules are changing. Like, with Gaza, platforms have put in new rules to identify and shadow ban or like slow down posts that include them, like the Palestinian flag, for example. And that's just really harmful to the discourse as it exists on the internet. Like, moderation is important. Like, we need content moderation. Platforms cannot exist without it. The reason that people use these strange words and like shortcuts to get around it is because we don't know what rules are in place, even. We're kind of reacting to a space that we don't understand, just kind of intuitively looking to escape the blinkers, I guess.
I do wonder how many people actually quite like not seeing a lot of that. There's obviously been movements in the last few years about kind of not engaging with certain news things and opting out and how you manage that. And I'm very sympathetic to that, because I think if you're not in a good place mentally, having bad news thrown at you the whole time is not particularly helpful. I don't think you need to know the news every second of every day. But then also you have got to a point where there are a lot, I think that's where the whole like trad wife thing comes from, to be honest, is that harking back to not a world where nothing bad happened, but a world when you didn't know about it. Are we just generally too informed right now? Like, I do really try and curate my media diet now to think about what I'm consuming and when.
I do think we're too informed is maybe the wrong word, but we're consuming too much media.
Fair enough. I don't think there's necessarily much informing
it's
going
more
on.
Like,
very good point.
You're just in a deluge of content and you can't navigate it. And it's not building your understanding of anything. It's just like bombarding you with stimulus that you can't knit together into a coherent picture. And so I think this is where this thing of doing your own research and like a distrust of the media comes in more, just because people find it harder to navigate this landscape. And so they choose their own solutions, whether that's ignoring the news or being better about curating what gets to you, or constructing this like trad wife identity for yourself that means that you have an excuse for not engaging. And not everyone needs to consume so much content, I think. Like, we're journalists and writers, like some people do need to be aware of what's happening all the time, but a lot of people don't. And I think social media has encouraged like maybe too much confidence that everyone knows what's going on.
And everyone's got the same kind of processing or literacy.
Yes, completely.
Media literacy. Like, I often am really surprised by how many people don't realize that different publications have different political viewpoints.
Yes.
And that just because you read something in one thing doesn't mean it's, you know, you can analyze data however you want, essentially. Like, there's no objective kind of data analysis. So I do feel like media literacy is at an all-time low.
I mean, there's a huge amount of context collapse online. And I think partly that's because algorithmic feeds, or the way social media has evolved, it has just thrown all types of content together into one mush. Like the Facebook feed, when it chose to start integrating news stories, made this incomprehensible combination of like family updates and important global news and random memes. Like, we don't separate between news and entertainment so much anymore. It's all just kind of thrown together.
But that's also, I think that's also so dangerous. I think you should be able to pick something up and know what you're going in for. I'm going in to learn about the news, or I'm going in to see who got married. I think it's like constant whiplash to be reading about someone's new baby and then reading about a genocide. And I think it's what makes people so furious online. And so quick to comment on people's personal content. You know, what I see a lot of now is like, why is this important? There's war going on in the world. As if there hasn't always been war going on in the world. Yeah. As if that hasn't always been the like madness of this world, is that some people are talking about nail polish and some people are fleeing for their lives. But I think it's because everything is in that they're bedfellows now, and they should not be bedfellows.
Right. I mean, everything gets pushed through the same tubes. Like, it's just all the same channels where everything gets mixed together, and that leads to that feeling, or a paradoxical feeling, of like, why is no one talking about this, or why is the media not covering XYZ, or even why am I not seeing my friends' life updates? Like, it's just confusing. We're in a confusing moment.
I think that's been the most destabilizing thing, is when things are no longer chronological, because I think that's our only, there's so much stability comes from knowing one thing comes after the other. And
it's silly,
it is
that
like
we have to
truly
say that.
Destabilizing. I will sometimes message a friend and say, oh, are you having the best holiday? And they'll say, I got back 4 months ago.
Oh my God.
I'll be like, what? I've just been shown it. I recently read in a science paper, I think it was from 2016, that women are less risk averse when they are ovulating. And I found that really interesting, as I knew that certain mental states or psychological states can lend themselves to bolder choices. So for me, it's being hungover. That's a really dangerous time for me to go shopping, as I make these kind of fever dream purchases. But I didn't realize how much hormones could come into it. And I have no idea what it's like for men. Have you looked into anything around hormones and taste?
That is really interesting. I have not personally. I think there should be more work done and writing done on taste and like personal consumption, period. I think it's like not taken that seriously for some reason, but it shapes so much of who we are. It's like how you express yourself. It's how you're feeling at a given moment, like being hungover. Like for me, sometimes I find that writing is really easy when I'm hungover, because I don't second guess myself as much. It's like too painful.
Yeah, you don't have
painful.
The capacity.
Yeah, exactly. Thinking too much is not possible. And so that mental state shapes my self-expression. It shapes like what I want to consume. So I think it's a super, super interesting idea.
Well, if you fancy writing that piece, I will read it. You mentioned about Nick Clegg in 2021, who's now at Meta, which I always find really boggling, and I think lots of people still don't know, that he had a suggestion of some law that I now can't remember, but that didn't come to pass. What was he suggesting, and what do you think should be done, if anything, legally regarding algorithmic marketing? Is it a legal thing? Is it actually just like a public messaging thing?
It kind of goes across both, I think. I mean, in the United States right now, we're having this convulsive debate over adolescent safety online that's interpreted as public health, even as it has a lot to do with legal regulation and data protection.
Right. Is that like what we have with our online safety bill?
Yes, exactly, yeah. But we're farther behind. Like, there's no bill,
obviously.
There's no momentum, there's no agreement. It's all terrible. But yeah, Nick Clegg had suggested that, oh, in the future, the Facebook algorithm will be customizable and you can opt out of it and there should be more algorithm-free zones on the internet.
Great.
Yeah, that would be lovely, except they've done absolutely nothing in that direction whatsoever. And their new, like, the Threads platform, which is Meta's copy of Twitter, essentially, is so much more algorithmic that it's just confounding. And so if they thought things should be less algorithmic, they are not making any steps to actually do that.
Can you opt out of any of that? So I now have gradually got smaller and smaller with my social media usage, and I just use Instagram now. Twitter used to be my favorite, but it obviously just got very depressing when it became X. And I was wondering, like, can you opt out of stuff? Because most of what I'm shown there are ads. Mm-hmm. And people I don't follow, and I'll end up liking something for someone I don't follow, and I'm like, I'm now in, and it looks really weird. Is there any way of opting out of all of that?
Well, not enough. So on Instagram, you can pause suggested posts for a month or something, and that can help a little bit. So it basically tells the platform to stop showing you quite so many ads and promoted things and, like, you suggestions. So that is good to try. But ultimately, you can't just turn off the recommendations. You can switch to a linear feed or a chronological feed on Instagram, but it's hard to do. It's not the default. Like, the platform isn't built for that anymore. And I do know there's a Digital Services Act that I think just passed in the EU that mandates the ability to fully opt out of algorithmic recommendations. So to just flip the switch and have nothing. And I think that would be phenomenal if we could all have that and just, like, permanently flip the switch and say no more recommendations.
Who would fight against that? Will companies make less money if we have that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think recommendations began in the first place because the chronological feed is not so good if you are not online all the time. Like, you're going to miss stuff that you want to see. You're not always tuning in at the right moment. So it's, like, coherent, but it's not optimized for consumption. And so if that was the case, I think there would be a percentage of users who were opting into it and then using the platform less, or realize that they actually don't need all of these recommendations, which are essentially disguised ads. So most users are very passive anyway, so I don't think this would ever be a huge hit on Meta's revenue, but it is net negative for their products, probably. And I think this is why email newsletters and, like, email updates are so popular right now, is because that mechanism is less algorithmic. You have more of a guarantee of reaching a higher percentage of your audience. You just have more control over that channel than you do on social media anymore.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think, so I have a Substack newsletter, and I think I have about a tenth of the readership, or maybe like an eighth or ninth of the readership that I have followers on Instagram, but more people are getting access to the newsletter than are on Instagram. Yeah, that's a really good point. And I'm sure it's benefited Substack, that whole thing.
Yes, yeah, for sure. I mean, Substack has kind of positioned itself against the algorithmic social media world, and for good reason. And I think it offers a really good product and has given a lot of people a sustainable way to do their writing, like, particularly writers, but also podcasters and fashion buyers and all sorts of creators, let's say.
So how can we find ways to escape the algorithmic flow state? Do you have any tools or tips you can share?
I did an algorithm cleanse. So for a period of 3 months, I just got off all of the, you know, feed-based platforms that I was on. So Twitter and TikTok and Netflix and Spotify and everything. And I did find that really helpful just to reset my own relationship with how I consume content. Like, it made me think about my choices a lot more. It made me work harder to know what I was consuming and to seek things out. But I think it basically comes down to what platforms you choose to use and how you choose to consume things. So rather than going on Spotify, you can go to Bandcamp and actually buy a digital album from a musician. And that is going to help the musician a lot more. And you might find yourself paying more attention to the album because you've invested in it, or because, you know, it's a finite piece of media that you can't just scroll away from. Or you can join the Criterion Channel, this like, you know, more artsy film streaming app that offers a lot more context and history and curation to what you're watching than Netflix does. So I think there are healthy choices to make, essentially. It's like eating organic food. You have to be aware of what you're doing.
But expensive. It can often end up expensive to make more meaningful choices. That's what feels so depressing about it.
Yes, for sure. I mean, buying an album on Spot or buying an album on Bandcamp will cost you more than a month of Spotify, which is like really a shame. But it is the only way that indie musicians are ever going to survive. So we need to do it. Like we things shouldn't be so cheap in a way. It's like,
I totally agree. We have a very and obviously it's easy to say that with a degree of privilege, but we have now, a lot of us have very friction-free lives. You can order anything and it can turn up the next day, or if it's food, it can be there in 10 minutes. And I feel like, what that has led us to is that more is good, but we now need to be going backwards. And you've written about that before, I think, haven't you? About divesting.
For sure. I think you can divest from that attention economy and like stop lending it your attention that gets commodified. I mean, I just did a New Yorker column about dumb phones and like people going back to flip phones.
Yes, those are really on the rise, aren't they? I would love that. The only incredibly annoying thing is that all my kids' school and childminder groups are all on WhatsApp.
There are some that have WhatsApp.
There
are like different combinations.
I would do that for sure. I'm going to look into it.
Yeah. There's even these accessories that let you block specific apps on your phone at specific times. Not just like screen time, but literally block you from using them. So I think there's more ways to kind of shackle ourselves, basically, because we can't resist.
My brother does that with my teenage nieces. As soon as they leave the kid, I think it's a really good point. He doesn't want them to ever be on any kind of apps in their bedroom on their own, because obviously that's where a lot of like teenage distress comes from. Anyway, as soon as they leave the kitchen, all those apps disappear. As soon as 9 p.m. hits, all those apps disappear.
We should all do that.
We should all do that. They really benefit from their dad being like a tech geek.
Yeah.
Kyle, thank you so much for talking to me today about your brilliant book, Filter World. I'm so grateful.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a fun chat.
Thank you for listening to Doing It Right. Don't forget, the whole of Series 4 is available to binge now. If you liked the show, please do give it a rating or a review on iTunes. And if you want to chat more about any of the episodes, you can email me at doingitrightpod@gmail.com. Doing It Right is presented by me, Pandora Sykes, with sound by Kelsey Bennett, and production by Pandora Sykes and Kelsey Bennett.